Hello, everybody. This is Alex Watts, and this is the Endofunctor podcast. Today, I have the co-founders of Mace, which is an aggregator on Monad. These guys are Harm and Ritz. And guys, I would love to learn more about you. I'd love to learn about your background. I'd love to learn about what you're building. I'd love to learn about your ideas and what it is you're bringing to the table on Monad. First things first, before you guys were building in DeFi, what were you guys doing?
So, I've always had an interest in computers and technology. I think despite probably having the mind for engineering, I gravitated towards programming specifically because, you know, it was just more accessible to be working in the computer virtual space than is to be building by hand. I do have some, I'm not sure if you can see it. I am starting to get into electronics, but we'll see how that goes. So I think in high school is where my those kinds of aspirations really started happening. I was always very entrepreneurial. I actually started out my first income making paid Gmod mods. So if several years ago you played Dark RP and there was the like Aritz Cracker ATMs, like that was me. That was it. Started out there. I was also in, I also did FRC robotics as well. So FRC is basically I don't know if it's international, but it's definitely like a North America wide robotics championship where you have like these high schoolers competing by building a robot in order to participate in like various activities. So it's usually, it's kind of like Olympic game kind of thing. We can follow up more of that there.
Were the robots fighting?
The robots don't fight, but they do compete. That's so awesome. So every year the game's different. I was one of the programmers. Actually, that was my when I did C++ like kind of seriously, right? And then around the same time I learned like JavaScript web development stuff. I did freelance work for a couple of years. Though I tried to go to university. Turns out I don't perform well academically. And there were some other things going on at the time. Biggest problem is that I actually drank too much of the solo founder Kool-Aid. So I tried to just start multiple businesses doing literally everything myself and then burnt out doing so. Fast forward to tangentially, I was aware of EVM, like Ethereum stuff at the time. So I at least learned a bit of Solidity and did a few small projects there. But then more present time, I started working with one of Harm's friends, trying to build something on Solana. Unfortunately, the product launch coincided with the collapse of FTX, so that didn't take off as well as it should. But eventually, around the same time, Harm left his previous company, GooseFX, to try to start at his own thing. And he took me along for the ride, and
it's awesome.
It was an adventure, and eventually we settled. We found that Monad would be a good opportunity to kind of like give us our big break, right? So,
Harm, what were you up to before getting into DeFi?
Yeah, so I'll also share a little bit about my history as well. So, yeah, in university, studied like financial math as well as CS. Which I think is a perfect combination for DeFi. Would see a lot of the parallels in some of my classes, but also see a lot of like the missing kind of links. And went to school in Waterloo. So obviously Ethereum and Vitalik was like very big. So got to see some of the early developments with DeFi like firsthand. Obviously just did school for a few years. And then around the time of like 2020, there was like a Solana global hackathon happening. I was trying to learn Rust. I thought it'd be a great way to kind of learn by like, you know, development and, joined a team, which, ended up, I guess, being the co-founder, given it was just like a couple of us at the time. And we ended up getting some interest from Jump Capital. So we ended up kind of going through the whole, startup arc, getting capital, building a product for a number of years. And then, obviously FTX and a few other market factors kind of prevented us from, I guess, achieving a lot of the, market success that you would, want to kind of, get to after, that point. And then we also, or at least myself, saw that there was, a growing opportunity with Monad. And then also, I think I also changed my thesis on what, we actually wanted to build, which originally was kind of novel AMM design. And we did like single-sided liquidity pools on Solana. So was very much in that frame of things. But we realized that DEX aggregation was actually, where a lot of like end users, engage with as an application, et cetera. So we thought we should target that on Monad, given we would have kind of the first mover advantage. And also given our like team skill level, we would be able to, have something, really, really great to actually build there. So yeah, so that's what we did. And then, close to like 2 years ago, Ritz and I started working together and I've been working. And we've obviously iterated a few times as well over that time. But I would say around like a year ago is kind of when like Mace kind of came together. We did do a rebrand, but at least the idea of what we wanted to build and the actual work started about that time. So yeah, it's been great since then.
The writing was on the wall for our previous project by then. We were like,
Yeah, exactly. I'm sure you know how that goes.
I've actually only ever done one startup. So I think first question, when I think of Mace, I think there's like two different things that kind of come to my mind, right? On one hand, there is, Mace that, someone might carry in their purse to, fend off, Solana hackathon people. And on the other hand, there is Mace as in like, a knight is holding this mace and he's going to bash in the other knight's armor. Are either of those where the name comes from or why Mace? Why Mace?
Well, to answer that question, it actually is the latter. I'm sure we've all like played Diablo and other, medieval style games. So, the weapon Mace just always was really cool and it's actually the logo. So funny, more people don't make that connection, but yeah, I would say most people think it's the former, which is kind of funny. Good, I guess, like,
I didn't know that.
On the team, we kind of did have like a funny like acronym for Mace as well. Like market, aggregator for capital efficiency, like other fun names that we came up with. But I would say generally like, the weapon and kind of that context is more.
Our previous project was also medieval themed. So yeah. it just seemed for us internally, just seemed like the evolution of it. Yeah. Right. But that's kind of funny.
So question for you guys, because y'all both were on Solana and you were very, deep inside of the SVM ecosystem. When most people think of at the SVM, they think of, very engineering minded, like individuals and very engineering focused builders. How did you find the transition from Solana to an EVM blockchain, Monad? Mm.
So I guess I can definitely take this one. It's actually kind of interesting because, that is what most people think when it comes to switching these kinds of blockchains, like, oh, why would you work with Solidity? But the thing is, the vast majority of the work that our team does isn't Solidity focused at all, right? And even when I was working with Solana and the SVM, to me, Solana was the excuse to actually start learning Rust in earnest. Probably should have mentioned that earlier. But I didn't necessarily want to use frameworks like Anchor or any of that. Personally, when it comes to the way that I run projects and the way that I like to manage the team is that I want the work to have as many transferable skills as possible. So learning Rust for Solana contract development enabled me to learn Rust for programming Arduinos. And in fact, the RGB lights in my computer is running custom Rust firmware that I wrote myself for controlling the RGB lights from scratch, no external libraries used, right? So, and that knowledge of how to develop for embedded systems enabled me to write better Solana smart contracts, right? That use less gas execution and stuff like that. And when it comes to the way that we are designing our system now, the vast majority of it is Rust backend service work, right? Like, so like our entire, basically 99% of our stack on the backend is Rust. Like we use Rust to invoke our state. Right. And, you know, and again, that it also gives a lot of transferable skills of how do we build distributed systems in general and still have, you know, reproducible deploys, scalability and all that stuff. Sorry, I realized I didn't directly answer your question. Basically, the answer is the transition was more so from doing mostly on-chain work to doing mostly off-chain work rather than moving blockchain networks in general.
That's interesting. So when it comes to like that distinction between on-chain and off-chain, let's dive into that, because that's something that I find to be fascinating, especially inside of like the realm of asynchronous execution, like on Monad. Mm-hmm. That transition for you guys from, you know, more on-chain logic to off-chain logic, was there anything in particular that you noticed about making that change, like any difficulties that arose that were unexpected during that process, or what really stood out to you as like the outcome of switching from off-chain to on-chain, or from on-chain to off-chain?
Well, it's more so the fact that like you actually have to develop backend infrastructure, and you can't just shove all your data into like IPFS and smart contracts and have everyone else host your state for you. So it's just all of a sudden you actually have to manage things now, right? That's which to distill it down, that's the biggest thing, right? You now all of a sudden have to think about, oh, how are we going to deploy this? How are we going to do updates? How are we going to not lose data, right? So just generally, that was the biggest difference between doing things on chain and off chain.
That's funny. Like I think a lot of people when we talk about that, they'll bring up how, you know, having things on chain is like, you know, trustless, permissionless, etc. My company has a lot of stuff on chain too. My favorite reason for that is that I never have to worry about anything on chain going down and causing, you know, PagerDuty to go off at 3 a.m. So
yeah, exactly. You know, like, yeah, have everyone else store your data for you.
Yeah. Very cool. Very cool. So you guys are aggregators. You guys are right now I believe the top aggregator on Monad testnet. How have you guys approached differentiating yourself in this space? Because being an aggregator is a very, very prestigious role inside of an ecosystem. And it's also very technical, because you have to have it's my understanding, you have to have a very deep understanding of many of the exchanges inside of that ecosystem. And so my question for you is, how have you guys approached this, and how have you looked for ways to differentiate yourself from the competition?
Yeah, it's a really good question. So I guess we kind of had a lot of like context on, you know, AMM development as well. Like we've done that in the past. So we kind of understood kind of like what teams themselves, you know, are trying to solve, the problems they have. So, you know, when it came to then being an aggregator and actually, you know, working and integrating all these different teams, we, you know, I think we had a little bit more context than probably most teams just starting from that root problem itself. So that was definitely extremely beneficial. And then in terms of like the other aspects of like, you know, managing, you know, that, you know, workload or that understanding the customer and user like aspects versus just like building the AMM infrastructure where, you know, kind of just, you know, get it rolling and then people will interact. But actually being that first interaction you might have with the blockchain, you know, do you make it easy? Do you then, you know, enable those users to interact with other DeFi protocols, right? So that's a lot, you know, to then like manage and handle, you know, because we did build on Solana for a number of years and we saw the evolution of, you know, other aggregators like Jupyter develop and things like that. We definitely saw, you know, kind of a little bit more about the playbook and kind of how to handle things on our end. So that was definitely extremely helpful. And I think so far, you know, we've been doing a good job at that, hopefully. But obviously there is still a lot of work to be done, and we are obviously on testnet. So, you know, we'll be doing a lot of iterations and making it obviously better over time. But yeah, I think like our team having the technical skill set, both from like a knowledge as well as experience standpoint, but then also having, I guess, like that awareness of, you know, market trends and how things go in a developing ecosystem. I think those were really important. And also us knowing really early to work with, you know, as many teams as possible, you know, have those conversations, you know, start integrating and kind of like building out the foundation for all that to exist, I think was also really important and something we targeted. And I guess I'll pass it over to Aritz to, I guess, share a little bit more as well. But yeah, generally speaking, that's kind of the framework that we use to develop our, you know, to develop Maze.
Yeah. I can definitely go a bit more on the technical side later, but part of my journey that I kind of said at the beginning with me crashing and burning on multiple of my 100% genius self-made startups is that it's not like, it's definitely not enough to have a good technical solution for something. You need to be able to capture mindshare in order to gain, in order to have any sort of success on this front, right? So, and for us, and again, one of the things that we did is that when Monad Madness happened, despite not being one of the teams on stage, we still managed to get a working product demo for them. And, you know, Harm literally approached people during the convention as things were being presented to show people, hey, look, unlike these guys that are on stage, we actually have a working product, right? So, nice. Well, I mean, I'm obviously like inflating it a little bit, right? But again, a lot of that building mindshare is at the very least looking like you have that first mover advantage and already kind of seeding, sowing those seeds very, very early, right?
Harm, you had mentioned integrating like partners and integrating, I'm assuming exchanges. Can you guys dive into that a little bit and elaborate on like what that looks like, both from a business development standpoint as well as from a technical standpoint for you guys with your own design and infrastructure?
Sure. Yeah, I'll cover the first part of that. So in terms of like the business development side, you know, it's very typical, I guess, just, you know, as any other team would approach another team to work together. So we reach out, we, you know, obviously, you know, mention who we are, kind of our process. Then, of course, you know, just ask for their integration documentation, which could be as simple as, you know, just a contract address, just so that we can effectively, you know, figure out how to perform the swap operations, you know, with their decks, you know, and then whatever else is needed from like a marketing or just, you know, from that standpoint. So just getting company logos, all that stuff. But it is quite basic. I mean, you know, we have a really great way of where we effectively just develop like a wrapper, and then we can kind of ad hoc add exchanges, assuming they're still the same like underlying infrastructure, similar to like Uni V2, most of the AMM DEXs are. So makes things a little bit easier on that end. With integrations such as like Karoo and other order book DEXs, of course, have to make some modifications. But generally speaking, once we have, you know, that wrapper built, we can then, you know, just add more teams. So it becomes easier. So we did, you know, of course, make that in mind of scalability. So that's been great. And then in terms of like, you know, solving the solution of what an aggregator is or aims to solve is, yeah, we want to have as many, if not all of the available liquidity sources, both on and off chain, in order to, you know, guarantee to the user that, yes, by, you know, coming to Maze or, you know, using a platform that routes through Maze, that you are guaranteeing best pricing, right? And if we're not able to solve that, then we've kind of already lost that war. So that's kind of like what we're always aiming to solve. And yeah, I'll let Aritz share a bit more on that as well.
So again, when it comes to adding new DEXs, the majority of the work is actually is twofold. Number one, we have what we call our adapters. So this is basically kind of, as Harm said, like a wrapper where we wrap, you know, our generic trade calls, like our route subsets, like, oh, these are the exchanges we want to do with that specific route with this specific DEX, right? So what we expect is that when our adapter is called, the ERC-20 balance on the address currently doing the trade should change, right? And this was the result of that trade. So we add that adapter. That means our router is now capable. And we use delegated calls for this. So our main router does delegated calls to our adapters. So that way, when the ERC20 balance changes, it is the ERC20 balance of the router address that changed, not the balance of the individual adapters, right? So that's how we can plug more DEX types into our router. That's how we modularize that. And then the second part is pool discovery. So we've got just some, infrequently ran GitHub action where its entire job is to just discover all the pools from all the DEXs, and then it updates a config file, and that config file gets pushed to our solver. You can actually query our endpoint now for supported exchanges, and it's literally like this megabyte long JSON of all the exchanges of each individual pair, and it doesn't matter, it's all in memory anyway, right? So it costs us literally nothing to serve it. So
would I be correct in assuming that, so like let's say I launch a brand new DEX with a like swap formula that is something I just like made up and it is completely random and never before seen. Mm-hmm. Would I be correct in assuming that what you guys would do in addition to discovering the DEX is there would now be a new, like you would deploy a new smart contract that has like the integration points, like, what to call, like what my mm-hmm. interface is. And then your router would delegate call your new smart contract that contains the interface and like interaction like functions for my new exchange. Is that the right
model? Yeah, exactly.
Okay. Awesome.
And it is actually that adapter that is used during solving of the route.
Could you elaborate more on what that means?
Okay. So this is a little bit of our secret sauce here.
Let's go.
So the basics of the architecture, which at the time of saying this is still in development in a couple of places, but this was the design goals from the beginning. So much like the Monad team themselves, we were asking, hey, what is the biggest latency point of actually executing the EVM? It's state latency. So how do we get that as slow as possible? So the way that we're approaching this is that number one, we have a service that would be ran on a node that we host. And the entire job of this service is to basically scrape the state of all the contracts that we actually care about, which are the DEXs and the ERC20 addresses and their dependencies, right? So we got a system that figures that out. What are the contracts and what are the dependencies and what are their current state? We then take that partial snapshot and then we just distribute it to wherever our solver is actually running. So this adds a layer of scalability because that means we can deploy a bajillion solvers, not that we would because that would be expensive, that are all reading from this read-only state backing, right? And it's kind of like EVM simulation calls, but not really. So basically what we're doing is that we have this partial snapshot, right? And while we are exploring the routes, we are creating new EVM instances, a semi-custom EVM thing, which then uses that as a state backing, and then we simulate a transaction, right? But then that it's a copy on write database, so like it creates like a new partial snapshot using this bigger partial snapshot as a backing, and then that's how those during the route solving, that's how it's done in a manner similar to how GPS route solving is, but instead of the heuristic being how much distance have you traveled so far or how much time did it take for you to get to point A to point B, the heuristic is how much slippage have we experienced during that time and how much gas have we consumed during that time.
Would copy on write would an appropriate mental model for what you're discussing be similar to how with Ethereum, but not in the SVM, but how in the EVM, whenever one contract calls another contract, it kind of copies state to a degree so that it has the original state to fall back to if that call reverts?
Yeah. It's kind of like that.
Okay. Interesting. But then you guys are focusing on different metrics or different values in order to like optimize. That's very interesting.
We are purely optimizing for maximum value, as in like maximum ERC-20 balance of the token you're at minus the value of the gas consumed. It's very like ends driven. And the idea, and you know, we'll see this more as our system is more developed, is that because the state that we actually need is all in memory, that we wouldn't have any of the usual latency storage issues when it comes to, you know, executing the EVM that many times. And because we're using Rust, we don't have to worry about like the world stopping every time we do a garbage collection. So we can allocate a bajillion objects and have them just be cleaned up automatically, right? Yeah,
some people would say you can configure when the Golang garbage collector goes off so that it can go off in between the blocks so that it's not in the hot path. I don't know anyone who would say that, but
Discord, you know, moved away from Go for a reason, because the total engineering time it took to do like a minimal implementation of, I think it was like their media processing API or something, like their initial implementation already outbeat their handcrafted Go solution. So like,
yeah, like Go's just not blazing fast.
It's not blazingly fast. No. And again, the additional benefit is, you know, well, Go already does this. So, you know, statically, near statically compiled binary. So you just put your app there and launch it and it works. Yay.
Right, so. For you guys, so you've got this like elaborate state, you've got it distributed. I'd like to learn more about that distribution though, right? I'd like to learn more about how you guys are looking at the infrastructure, and in particular, how you guys are looking at like not your solution necessarily, but the way that users like interact with you. Like for instance, you know, if you've got a user down in Australia, he's not going to have a good time if he's like waiting for a solution from a solver running in, you know, New York. And so I'd love to learn more about how you guys are thinking about your network topology.
So this is something that is still in the planning stage, though I do have ideas toward that end. I have no idea whether or not they'll actually work out. We're just working on making our solver work fast first and then dealing with that, especially as we get closer to mainnet. But I actually want to see if, because our deployment mechanism is like we use heavily infra as code tools, right? So we use infra as code. So we're able to like, and you know, we set things up in a way where we can hopefully scale things with relative ease. Right now, there's no like automatic metrics toward that end, but you know, if we're able to just increase a number and the load balancer takes care of it, then great. But in terms of like serving users where they're at, I want to see if I can like if we have like a minimum amount of nodes worldwide, let's say like 3 or 4, and then, you know, once we do have these kinds of metrics more observable, if we can kind of in the background on the front end, you know, without using users' real location data or anything, if we could try to like have them ping those 4 worldwide nodes and see if we can like triangulate the user's internet position, and then see if we can kind of, you know, so we basically would build out a graph of all the nodes we can deploy to and be like, are they around here? Maybe we can like launch some more instances here and see how that goes. Again, these are just ideas, but thankfully we have a flexible enough deploy process that we'd be actually able to execute them.
Let me ask you guys this, because we're talking a lot about like users, we're talking about a lot about optimizations. A lot of these optimizations sound very technical, which I love, and I'm a big fan of what you guys are doing, as you know. How have you found the process of communicating some of this stuff to users? If you even do it at all, I guess.
I mean, that's a really good question. In our, like, it's been a little difficult to some degree, like, given the fact that a lot of the stuff that we're working on, they are in the back end. So not really, like, observable by the user to some degree. Like, sure, some latency improvements, you know, there'll be more tokens, more pairs, etc. But a lot of it is kind of in the back end and kind of, like, you know, abstracted away from them to some degree. So we have been thinking about ways to actually disseminate some of those updates and some of what's happening to, you know, retail friendly, you know, verbiage. So it's actually a process we're going through right now. But I think like maybe either like diagrams or like doing some sort of like comparative analysis or just mentioning, you know, like how this works in like a ELI first, you know, something like that, I think is probably a better approach. So kind of a problem we're going through right now. But yeah, given that like 90-ish percent of the work that we do at any given time is in the back end, it has been a little difficult, but yeah.
The biggest thing I feel like we can, the only thing we can really do toward that end is try to mitigate the sluggish factor as much as we can. Again, another Canadian call out. If you've ever used the Tim Hortons app, you know exactly what I'm talking about. And you know, any app that were made by front end developers who did not give, who did not care a lot about performance, right? We ideally want to make an experience where everything is like snap and like fast and snappy and things actually feel responsive, because it's not a thing that most users know how to quantify, but it is definitely a vibe that you feel when you click a button and then you kind of feel how it just took way too long for the app to acknowledge what you just did, right? And it kind of goes back to the solver. So right now our solve times is still in the range of several seconds, mostly because our partial state snapshot solution isn't 100% complete yet. But once that solution's in place and people are able to see, like, you know, as they are typing their amount, see like maybe not instant, but you know, because we still need to do debounce protection, but like seeing their results being displayed quickly and quickly in comparison to other applications, right? I think providing that kind of quick and responsive user experience is something that would be innately valuable, even if it's something that you can't directly promote, if that makes sense.
It does make a lot of sense to me. And I think that one of the things that we find fascinating is this sort of balance between responsive UX and then execution quality and like how high the quote is. Have you guys run into like any sort of trade-offs in that space between like quotes and like execution quality or anything like that? How are you approaching quoting in general?
Yeah, that's a good question. Okay, so this is something I can call out. So one of our posts on the Mace Twitter is you'll actually see like a kind of like a graph view of all the tokens. And when I said, you know, we're solving things similarly to like how a Maps app would solve it, I wasn't joking, right? So at that point, you start thinking, you know, of routing algorithms in a more general sense of like, okay, how do I get to point A to point B? There was a version of the Swaps app that was definitely non-viable. And that was one where for every token hop, or for basically for every neighbor, it calculated all the neighbors, right? And that was non-viable because the moment that you hit Monad or wrapped Monad, all of a sudden you now have to do like over 1,000 simulations, right? So even if, so let's say like your token is here, you want to go here. And even if like a route connection from here to here works, would theoretically work better rather than going here, here, and here, you kind of have to not go in directions that would increase your distance if you were to graph out everything like how we graph it out on our Twitter page. Because again, otherwise, the only way to guarantee that, you have to do like a bunch of simulations that, you know, will result in the worst case scenario, up to a minute of solve time. You would have the best quote guaranteed, but you wouldn't be able to use it by the time it's done solving, right?
Makes a lot of sense. Yeah, it's kind of like, you know, that trade-off between, you know, having the perfect solution versus the best solution.
Yeah.
Now.
Yeah. With that said, though, right now, like the currently deployed solver algorithm, even though if it takes a relatively low amount of hops between tokens, it does actually test every exchange for every individual trade that it is making. So at the very least, you are going to get the DEX with the most value at the end. So yeah, it is something we are working about that, and the trade-offs are definitely something we are balancing, but you know, we can't have the absolute best theoretical solution simply because simulating that path. Again, the moment you touch Monad or wrap Monad, you're already dealing with all of the tokens, since everyone deploys their token with a Monad pair, right? So
one of the things that I found back when I was an MEV searcher, and I think this kind of echoes what you were saying, is that some routes or some, like, you know, hops when you're traversing the graph are pretty fast, such as anything that's like a Uniswap V2 style, X times Y equals K. What I found is that anytime I ran into Curve in particular, the compute time would go way up because Curve likes to do, you know, for loops in their communicate or like their calculations of their like amount outs. And so I would hit these like nodes in the graph that would have much more complex math and calculations, and that I would like literally have to like, you know, factor in the complexity of the exchange when doing this, because otherwise, you know, we'd run out of time. One of the things I always thought was kind of interesting, though, is that I feel like building an aggregator on Ethereum mainnet with 12-second blocks is kind of like easy mode.
Yeah.
Would that be like a fair assessment?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah, definitely. And it's kind of interesting that you mention like that upper limit compute thing. At least from our perspective, number one, we're able to, again, we want to give the best codes for the user, so we're actually able to execute a lot of this stuff in parallel anyway. And number two, the inherent compute limit of the EVM kind of limits us from running away to the moon, like, very, very quickly. So we do have like a little bit of that safeguard just for the fact that gas limit exists, which is good. No one will ever execute a trade that takes up like more than the entire block space, at least theoretically. Fair. Someone might try, who knows?
So let me ask you this. So like when you guys are looking at these routes, these calculations, do you like cache the outcomes at all so that you don't have to recalculate for other people if there's like similarities? Are you like storing any of the data so that you can share between multiple users where maybe they want to swap different amounts but like the same tokens? Is there any sort of like caching system that you guys use for this?
Currently, right now, if that does become a pain point, like, and you know, when we do collect our stats and we see, oh, like this is a problem, that could be something we'd be looking towards. But again, fundamentally, the way that the system works currently is that, like, actually the biggest reason why you can't use our aggregator right now without connecting your wallet is because we are literally simulating you doing the trades, or you doing the trades via our router, right? So just from the sheer fact that we don't even care about how the underlying DEX actually works, we're just executing it during our solving. Being able to cache specific exchange ratios is a little dubious, especially when you get into things like novel DEX types and even something like order books, where, you know, you eat whatever is the current quote price of the market, and then another user comes along with a different amount. And it's not something that you can translate linearly anyway. Right. So I don't know if we were to ever do that. And if maybe it seems like we were experiencing low latency, that's definitely something I'd be willing to explore. But currently, right now, we are only caching the underlying EVM state and keeping that in memory, and then working on that.
Yeah, that makes sense. Yeah, we have discussed like stale while reloading and different like caching like mechanisms. Even spoken with like the Monad team on it as well. So it's definitely something we've thought about, but yeah, unless like, you know, we have some like scaling issue or some reason to optimize for that, which could happen, right? It's definitely a possibility. In the current, scope, we haven't, you know, needed that per se, but yeah, it's definitely something we've thought about, and potentially if needed, we can implement it, but, yeah.
Currently, I haven't seen any route resolve more than four hops. So
yeah, exactly.
Got it. And it seems to me like it would be easier if you guys are trying to scale faster, it'd be easier for you guys to just deploy more infrastructure to run more of these systems.
Exactly.
And caching would be relatively useless there unless you do it at like Cloudflare level or something like that, and I don't think you could cache your data in Cloudflare.
No, like this ain't static data, man. Especially something as fast as Monad. Like any a cache expiry of 1 second is already useless.
Too long, yeah.
Talk to me about context, that,
right? Where liquidity changes very fast, and you know, like, yeah. So you know, it just wouldn't be feasible for the.
If anything, we could the biggest before we even cache. The biggest thing I would look for is like, how do we make distributing our data to our nodes faster, right? That would be the first thing I would explore even before exploring that.
Got it. Let me actually double click on that real quick. So distributing data to your nodes faster, what data would that be? Would that be getting like the users?
That'd be the partial EVM state.
Got it. So you're not building that locally in the node or...
No, we are okay. So we have okay. So when I say nodes, I'm talking about like Mace nodes, not Monad nodes.
Ah, got it.
Yeah,
got it. Okay. Well, let's talk a little bit about Monad nodes, and in particular the subject of MEV, because I know you guys are very high context in MEV, and we had talked a little bit before about how liquidity might not always be there. Mm-hmm. How are you guys looking at MEV, and how are you guys looking at, in particular, the like intersection of MEV and aggregation?
It's a really great question. So, of course, like we're on the app layer side of things. So, to that context, yeah, like the MEV, you know, in that space, I guess exists around, you know, what slippage tolerance does the user set. How much actually is utilized to perform the swap, and is there, you know, some extra, you know, remaining amount that could be captured to some degree? So I guess like that would be like the MEV, you know, in our like specific domain that we'd worry about. Generally speaking, you know, right now, like as Aritz mentioned, we do really only account for like what is the best value for the user. So you know, we calculate that route minus gas costs and really present that to the user. That's kind of like the extent of where we go with the MEV. Is there something else that could be explored there potentially? But yeah, for currently, like the way we're thinking about it, yeah, we're just really just we're just concentrated on, you know, getting the best price executed. But yeah, Aritz, I'm sure, could share some additional details on that. But yeah, generally that's kind of, you know, where it sits in our context, just on the app layer.
Yeah.
Makes sense.
Generally speaking, when it comes to the way that I design things, is that I try to make every component like somewhat reusable. And I know that it's impossible, otherwise you just end up with a bunch of layers of abstractions. But there comes a point, right? And part of that is, again, going back to the whole partial state database thing and having our solver, you know, run its own EVM instance. You know, like who's to say that we can only solve routes against the current finalized or even the current latest EVM block, right? Who's to say that we can't run that against potential blocks while they're currently in consensus, right? Who's to say that we can only optimize for maximum ERC20 balance of the user? Like, yeah, that's currently what we've been building right now on top of these core principles of let's just cache the contracts we care about and solve for that. But in the event that we would want to, or we think of it advantageous to try to say, all right, so this is what the user can get now, but what can the user get in the future, right? There's opportunities to be explored there. And who knows, maybe it might amount to nothing. And you know what, like 0.5 seconds ends up not meaning much anyway. But at the very least, we have the underlying flexibility in the design allows us to explore these options.
Makes a lot of sense. When it comes to user acquisition on Monad in particular, how are you guys approaching, going out to market and like driving interest for your aggregator? Like, is there anything in particular that you've noticed about Monad and the Monad community that like stands out to you?
Okay. I'm sorry, Hart, but I love telling the story.
Go for it.
So you know how I mentioned how we had a demoable product on Monad Madness, right? Yeah. Back in November. So a little bit after that, we were thinking, okay, so we need to promote ourselves. What do we do, right? So in the end, and by the way, this was just running like on like a self-hosted Geth node with a block interval of 2 seconds, right? Like this is what it was running on, like a literally a dev node that we allowed the public to access. And we thought, okay, so you know what, let's just take our demo and release it to the public and see what happens. At the very least, we'll get people to stress test this variant, and you know, and we did actually collect some good data. But you know, now here's the thing. Apparently, you know, there are these AI scrapers going around scraping AIs for you know, Twitter feeds and whatever for news, and there's like these influencer Telegram groups that are all sharing data between each other. Somewhere along the chain, there was this misconception of Monad project testnet, therefore Monad testnet. So before Monad launched their own testnet, some people believed that Mace was the first Monad testnet for public consumption. And all of a sudden we gain 30,000 Discord members. So remember what I said about first mover advantage having the mindshare? Yeah, we kind of front run Monad's own launch accidentally. Nice. And now we have a bunch of users following us, which is good, which is great. We've captured awesome. That mindshare already.
What you mentioned Geth, like what blockchain were you guys running this on?
No, like literally, like, you know, the dash dash dev mode.
Oh, in Geth? Okay. Yes. Oh, yes, I do.
We literally spun up a Geth instance, that's configured awesome. It with 2 second block intervals, and people went wild. That's awesome. Look how fast it is, guys.
That's awesome. That's awesome. How, like for I guess from like a more long-term perspective, are there any things in particular that like users are focused on, or any priorities that they have, or any like requests that they have, or just, you know, preferences that you've noticed that they have that maybe aren't being covered by the broader aggregator market?
It's a good question. Outside of like, you know, of course, just having like all their favorite tokens. So that's just more on the integration side of things. We have had some feature requests that we're currently working on. Probably the most notable would be like limit order support. So because we currently work with like Kuru and some other order book DEXs, you know, we can of course support that, you know, even on our front end. So that's something we'll be rolling out soon. So I think users will, you know, really enjoy that. And I don't think that's currently deployed on any other aggregator on the Monad testnet. So I think that would be a first. Yeah, we have a few other things coming around the corner as well. We did launch also another marketing kind of campaign that we did was kind of launched like a Mace Pass NFT. So with that NFT, we have, you know, told our users that that would allow you to have like early beta access to some of our future releases. So we are working kind of on like a points program, should be kind of fun. And this, I think, will be the first, I guess, utility that we provide to the NFT holders, where they'll be able to test and you know, interact with that program early. I guess that would be something that's coming out that I'm not exactly sure if others have started incorporating yet, but definitely we would be bringing to the Monad testnet.
Yeah, and we're also just trying to be open to user feedback when it comes to improving the quality of life kind of things. One ticket that suggestion that was interesting is like, oh, I instead of like only seeing the verified tokens, I want the balances that I actually have to like be sorted up top, right? And the means that we are able to facilitate that is actually pretty interesting, because since we already have like a snapshot of the chain state, we could just for the, I think it was like nearly 1500 tokens that we have so far, we could just invoke the contract, query the balance of the user of all of them in parallel, and then have that as an API backend, so that way the front end doesn't have to do the heavy work of querying all the balances of all the contracts itself, because we have this like optimized state backing, like in-memory state backend for the EVM, that enables us to also offer a lot of these QOL features where you would necessarily usually only see that like in a wallet app or in an indexer or something like that.
Yeah, you guys are basically running a very light, like hyper optimized indexer for your own data.
Yep. Mostly,
I know you wouldn't like it to be called an indexer, Ritz, because of like the implications, but it could be used as one if you were to like, let's say, drive like a Formula One like race car, like in like traffic in Los Angeles.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, yeah. I mean, I think iterating over every possible Ethereum address would take too long, though.
I think it's impossible, right? Actually, I don't know.
Oh, everything, everything's possible. Do you just have several millions of years on your hands?
Yeah, valid. That's true. That's true. So let me ask you guys this. So like, for users, and this is something I'm really interested in. Users on Ethereum mainnet tend to be, you know, swapping their Ethereum, like their ETH to their, you know, wrapped Bitcoin, just very, very bland, very vanilla stuff, right? Mm-hmm. You know, some USDC, maybe a little bit of Tether if we're feeling extra spicy. You know, meanwhile, on Solana, it's like, you know, the users are trading their dog poop coin for Elon did 9/11 coin. And it's like, you know, it's a very different environment, I guess. My question for you is, you know, where do y'all think Monad is going to end up between those two spectrums?
Someone actually asked me a very interesting question, and to kind of relate to what you said, someone asked me, why do most scams happen on Solana? And I responded with, that happens because more stuff happens on Solana in general, right? So yeah, you know, people on vanilla Ethereum, they are trading their, you know, their Ethereum for wrapped Monad, maybe Tether, et cetera, right? But that, you know, like, the biggest reason why I don't use Ethereum personally is because of the high transaction costs and the fact that the block times are very long. Just on something like Solana, more stuff can happen in general. That's why people are trading their poop coin for their Elon did 9/11 coin, because that is just not feasible to do on Ethereum, right? And from what we've seen of the design of the Monad network so far, if Monad is able to achieve the same level of performance and transaction costs that Solana has, then we are going to see more of that, right? Granted, that also means we're going to see a lot more viable. How do I say this? Like, innovative projects hopefully going forward, just because you can do more things. But you know, obviously the shit coins is what gets memed on and publicized the most, so I think we're going to see that as well, and in a way that's already happening on testnet. So
that makes a lot of sense. I think one of the things I find really interesting with Solana is that, especially when you start looking at sandwiching and like sandwich attacks on Solana, a lot of that has to do with the fact that through Solana's like stake weighted QoS system, you're hitting multiple validators. And so it becomes like a one out of N adversarial actor, and you end up having your transaction leaked. If just one of the multiple validators on the path to the leader leaks the transaction, then that transaction gets leaked out to a whole bunch of people that can just sandwich it. Monad has RaptorCast. And the way RaptorCast currently works for Monad is that transactions get beamed to the current leader as well as the next three. So four leaders total. And so it looks to be, you know, assuming the MEV infrastructure supports sandwiching, which is still up in the air indecisive. But when we look at, you know, will these transactions be broadcast on Monad the way that they are on Solana, it looks to be a one out of four threshold in terms of if one of the four validators leaks the transaction, then you could have something like that.
That is interesting. I guess, I don't know. I guess that just depends what your design goals are. Cause on one hand, just like from the vibes from me, like not really thinking about it too often, I'm like, I feel like Solana's approach is more, you know, more marketable as a decentralized technology. But meanwhile, Monad, when you say like the leader in what exactly?
The validator that will make the block
the block. Okay. Interesting. So I'm just trying to figure out how you would prevent that kind of leakage, because like not everyone's going to be connected to the validator who happens to propose the current block.
Correct. So I think that so first of all, I think that this is something that can definitely change, and I would be surprised if it doesn't change before mainnet comes out. And so this is just the way it currently works on testnet. That's not necessarily how it'll work on mainnet. I can't imagine that everyone will have a direct, path to beam transactions straight to the leader.
No, because that can't happen unless, how is the client supposed to know who's going to happen to, say, hey, this is the new block, guys.
Yeah, know who the leader is. Yeah, ahead of time. Yeah, fair enough.
And also, don't multiple validators and nodes have to know of the transaction in order to propose competing blocks anyway?
So discovering the leader ahead of time is something that's very possible. There's a leader schedule. The interesting thing, though, is that this is a distributed system. So you kind of have to aim the transaction at, who's going to be the leader by the time transaction arrives. Yeah, and so that's why currently it's this like shotgun approach where you send it to the, current leader and then the next three. But eventually you'll run into some of the problems that Solana has along the lines of, well, there's too many transactions trying to get there at once. And so Solana added stake-weighted QoS. We are not yet aware of what Monad is going to do, but this is something that the Monad team is very, very good at. This is like their specialty. And so we're high conviction that they're cooking up something awesome. So let me ask you guys this. With regards to privacy and order privacy, is this something that you have looked into? Like from your point of view, if you get an order from a user, is this something that you would hope no one ever sees, or, is privacy a major concern for Mace right now?
We don't process orders ourselves. So it's not like it's right now, and the way that we intend to do things for the foreseeable future, especially because gas costs are a part of our route solving, the user is still going to very much sign their own transaction in order to execute the routes. So just on that alone, it's not necessarily our responsibility that other adversaries can see the user's order, because that's up to the way that their wallet app handles things anyway. Like we don't even broadcast their transaction to our node. Like we don't do that. The world does not know what our node is. Like we have a API key, or rather a unique path that we give to ourselves, and that's it, right? Hopefully the wallet app that the user is using isn't adversarial, and the nodes that it uses, is. If that is a problem, that could be something that we might look into. Wait, no, does the Ethereum provider even allow for this?
So this is a subject I can talk about for a lot. I think the TLDR would be that wallets, when a user signs a transaction, wallets, especially MetaMask, will always send that transaction to the RPC the user's connected to. What the wallet won't do is sign the transaction and then just like not send it to anyone and give it to you. But I think that one of the things that is worth considering is this concept of private order flow, which was a huge thing on Ethereum. I think on Solana, it's maybe not as big of a thing. And so the reason why I was mentioning that wallets, especially MetaMask, once they sign a transaction, they'll send it to the RPC, is that that makes it very difficult for you to have private order flow unless you're also running an RPC. And in order for you to run an RPC, you have to basically get the user to install your RPC. Your front end can't necessarily change the user's RPC for them, unless you want to just like bombard the user with a whole bunch of very aggressive, alarming pop-ups that will make the user think they're actively.
Yeah. They'll be like, like this app is requesting an RPC that we don't know about.
Yeah, it's pretty brutal. But I am curious though, because the transaction is going to an RPC, the alternative would be using something like a user operation, where rather than a full transaction, the user signing an operation, and then you bring in this like transaction bundler that pays the gas, and then the user operation reimburses. And so there's a lot of interesting things you can do there, especially around private order flow.
Oh yeah.
But the other interesting thing, my question for you guys is, would it be valuable for you to see, because like, even if the user signs the transaction and it goes off to the RPC, that's still an order. That's still going to change the price and maybe have an impact on the routes, right? And so maybe would that be useful information for you guys to plug back into your state in memory?
So this, that's a good question. So this is one of the reasons why, you know, like we will have the option to try to execute multiple routes on chain for the user. Like where instead of just having the one route for the router, we would have multiple routes with, you know, varying degrees of liquidity behind them, right? So that way, you know, if users were to do the same thing and that ends up not happening anymore, we are working with, you know, with an on-chain solver solution, hint, hint, nudge, nudge, that that would allow us to have to so maybe, you know, one user might still get a better outcome to the other, but there would still be some good outcome based on these routes, which is why, like, even when we do allow on-chain liquidity, it's not like we're just going to have, you know, the fully DEX option and the off-chain liquidity option. So it's not like we would have like one path or the other. We would have like multiple DEX paths. And then maybe if there is like an off-chain bid, we would have that as well, right? So, you know, and, you know, that's the good thing about Monad's fast block times is that by the time things change, we would know about them very quickly. So, right.
Got it. So it kind of lets you like submit multiple paths. And if things do change and one path isn't available, it doesn't matter because you've already got these like, you know, backup paths queued up. And so you can just, whatever the best thing is at the time of execution is what the user will get.
Yeah,
exactly. Yeah. That way, like we effectively limit, if not remove, you know, the fact that a transaction could fail. So if a user submits it, it's going to go through. Yeah. At least that's the goal. Yeah.
And we'll give the option. And I think our front end already has this, like a slippage tolerance. So we give the option whether or not I don't care. Just give me whatever is good. Or no, I actually want the number I see on screen plus or minus like whatever percentage, right? So yeah, we the most important thing is giving the user options on what they actually want to happen. Because you know what, some users might want it to fail based when we can get a good quote, right? So
makes sense. How are you guys thinking about off-chain liquidity? I think the mental model a lot of people have is, you know, market makers, which really they're takers in most cases, who are, you know, managing inventory. They've got some inventory on, let's say, Binance. They've got some inventory on chain, and they're typically staying delta neutral by, you know, skewing or balancing their inventory between the two. And, you know, I think that it is, on one hand, you know, a good thing to, you know, have more liquidity and have more options. On the other hand, a lot of these, you know, market makers are really just, you know, proxies for Binance. I would love to get more, or if not Binance, you know, some other obscure, you know, CeFi exchanges. I would love to get y'all's take on how you're looking at off-chain liquidity, both in terms of how you guys are incorporating it for your users, but also, you know, how you think about it more broadly in the scope of, like, is it good for DeFi?
Yeah, so I guess I'll start with the first question, like how are we incorporating it? So we will be, you know, utilizing off-chain liquidity through an RFQ, you know, through RFQ with, you know, a partner that we work closely with, hint, hint. The idea there is that, you know, for that initial mission of like, can we offer the user the best price? I don't think would be valid if we didn't take into account, you know, off-chain liquidity, given that, you know, market makers or, you know, whatever sophisticated players are more likely to quote the asset at a tighter spread and provide more liquidity, you know, at current price. So if we just removed that aspect, yeah, we would have the best DEX price, but we wouldn't really be able to say it's the best price, right? Full stop. So, yeah, I think, you know, as a competitive DEX aggregator, I think you kind of need to do both. And we will be incorporating RFQ. And, yeah, there will be market makers or, you know, other players that will be able to bid on those orders. And then, as Aritz mentioned, that will then, that price will then, you know, be, you know, included in our solver. And if that price beats whatever DEX price or whatever, that's what gets executed. And yeah, to answer the second part, the more, I guess, philosophical question, like, is this good for DeFi or decentralization or whatever? I still think it is, because effectively it's now given giving users more flexibility. So rather than, you know, needing to have an account, being KYC'd, or even just being in a geographical location that permits you to use said platform that could have the best liquidity. Like, as an example, you know, Binance or Coinbase have the best, I don't know, MonUSDC prices. You should be able to get those, and you shouldn't have to, you know, go through a bunch of hops and, you know, submit all these documents or whatever to make that happen. I think that's not ideal, especially in like a world where we live in, where, you know, opportunity cost is, you know, very expensive, especially if you are using DeFi or in different tools. So, yeah, for us to, you know, incorporate both and present that to a user in a really easy to use manner, I think is actually a good thing. And I think by doing that, I think you're also going to push more people on chain as well. Because I know, like, you know, especially pre-FTX, I think it was like really widely accepted, especially by a lot of boomers and, you know, older people in crypto, that a centralized exchange is like a bank account and just keep your coins there. Even Ledger is too much risk. And, oh no, I will never set up a wallet. Like, what do I need a wallet for, you know? So all of these takes, I think over time have been not only disproven, but really painful for anyone that's gone through, you know, one of those crises. So I think as people now are a little bit more comfortable with wallets and managing, you know, their own assets, which I think in today's day and age is really important anyway, I think it just provides those users the tools that they need to do what they need to without having to, you know, go through as many hoops. So yeah, for us, and I think the general user, it is beneficial. And especially, you know, in a mainnet context, you know, I think it's really hard to beat market makers on pricing, especially on size, in a mainnet context. And I think that's the general consensus with, you know, pretty much every, you know, blue chip trading pair on another ecosystem. So yeah, we would follow the same approach.
And not only that, the moment that market makers, you know, outbid the DEXs, it becomes on-chain liquidity anyway.
Yeah, fair enough.
Can you elaborate on what you mean by that?
Well, I mean, like, so you know, we have these market makers, right? In terms of the flow of assets, right? We have these so-called market makers working on so-called off-chain liquidity, right? Now, when the user interacts with the DEX and they make a swap that happens to use a market maker's bid, like, that is now, that asset now becomes something in that user's control and therefore becomes part of the more on-chain ecosystem. It is now asset that has kind of gone out of the more centralized exchange ecosystem and into the on-chain ecosystem. So in essence, being able to further bridge that gap between those who are able to optimize for, you know, central exchange solutions and those who are participating in the more on-chain ecosystem, I think that could be something that is beneficial towards retaining liquidity on-chain as a whole.
So it's kind of like the market makers are maintaining that inventory of whatever the token the user is buying. They're maintaining it on chain, but it's really just like, they're not going to do anything with it. It's not going to be capital that flows through the ecosystem. Yeah. It's not going to be like, you know, deposited, or it's just there to be traded, you know, but like the user is actually going to use whatever they're buying. That's why they're buying it. And so exactly, you're going to get that like capital velocity increase, you know, the multiplying effects of that on the value.
It's a good idea. At least it sounds good.
Yeah. Yeah. So one of the things you mentioned there is, I think you used the term bridging, and I know that in what you were talking about, you're talking about, like, you know, kind of bridging, you know, the funds more of like, you know, metaphorically.
Oh, but
I'd love to speak more literally about the concept of bridging. Have you guys started exploring like bridge integrations, and have you started exploring, you know, swapping from a token on one chain to a token on Monad?
Yeah, that's a really good question. Short answer, yes. So we have internally kind of spoke about, a bridge solution. We even wanted to do this on the testnet and at least showcase this functionality. So an idea that we had on the team was to effectively allow users through one of these bridge solutions to, you know, move tokens from like Sofolia or Arbitrum testnet to the Monad testnet. So that would be kind of like an easy way to, you know, demonstrate that. And of course, that would translate to mainnet as well. So that's something that we do have on our like to-do list. We do plan to probably push that a little closer to, you know, obviously mainnet or some announcements around mainnet, just because I would assume most bridge partners aren't super active on a testnet context. So it would probably be a little bit more fun and more liquidity for sure closer to then. But definitely on our to-do list, something we definitely will incorporate, and something that we definitely will support for mainnet, because we definitely do understand that chicken and egg problem. And I think by having something, you know, like usable solutions, really easy for people to move their assets from whatever chain they're on to Monad to interact with DeFi and other applications there is going to be a necessity. So we'll definitely support that, especially given like what our product aims to do, which is hopefully be your first interaction with Monad, and then allows you to get started with everything else. So bridging would of course be on that list. So yeah.
And even so, to kind of like elaborate on this is also why like building that initial mindshare is extremely important, because that also opens the door for things like wallet integration. And let me tell you, as someone who's used like Phantom Wallet and even Cake Wallet, like I just use whatever the wallet app provides me without really caring what the underlying mechanism were. Sometimes I would click the links like, oh, it's using this service I never heard of. Cool. But yeah, again, we can come up with the best technical solution, but we also have to have that mindshare, which is why I'm glad that we're having as many integration partners as we're currently doing, and we're continuing talks behind the scenes toward that end.
That resonates with me. I think it's very difficult to get the mindshare if there's another entity that's like already there that has captured it, especially if they've done that thing where they've reworded or like relabeled or redefined some words. And I see that happening a lot in crypto when there's competition. One team will come in and then another team will come in with a very similar product, and they just describe it in a completely different way, and it just leads to confusion among users, and it mm-hmm. can be interesting. Definitions as a moat, as I like to call it.
It really, I think it's just, it doesn't just confuse users, it confuses me. I can't keep up with all these new acronyms. Like, what does alpha even mean anymore, you know?
I like to think of it as a portfolio performance measurement, but that's me being old-fashioned. So question for you guys, because we're talking about especially like wallet integrations and in the context of user experience, have you guys looked into, speaking of definitions, gas abstraction, aka gasless transactions, aka ways to prevent your wallet, your users' wallets from hitting the users with a pop-up where they have to, you know, go through the, you know, how much are you willing to pay menu and all that.
Yeah, it's another thing that I think we've talked about, but not as extensively. I guess it, you know, that's something more, I guess we'll have to get a general read from like users and, you know, how things have played out on like a mainnet context elsewhere. Specifically with like Solana, which is like where we have the most experience, quite uncommon, generally speaking, because gas fees are very low and users are also not really like asked to input that. It's already just like general minimum amount that's like usually required anyway. I guess users can, you know, add priority fees and stuff, but mostly not like done by every app. So yeah, I guess in like a general context, we haven't really seen it needed when gas fees are really low. Obviously, Monad will also have extremely low fees. So I guess, I guess we'll just have to wait and see if it becomes, you know, something that people want or care about. And if so, I guess we can explore that path. But generally speaking, if gas fees are low, I'm assuming most people wouldn't necessarily care, or it wouldn't necessarily affect their user experience. But yeah, I guess it's maybe just a little too early for us to have like a strong opinion on it. But
in terms of technical solutions on this front there, we've already briefly mentioned things like user operations and having someone else actually execute transactions on the user's behalf. So if it were to become a problem, you know, we would have means toward that end.
Yeah.
But at least, you know, from me personally, I always find it doubtful to be in a situation where you have, say, like, you know, hundreds or thousands of dollars worth of assets in one token and not have the underlying native token as well, at least like a couple of bucks worth of that. And if transactions are going to be cheap, then great. Like I've interacted on Polygon before, right? So, I mean, like, that's an example of a relatively low fee EVM ecosystem. So, you know,
that resonates with me. Yeah. I think it's like, you know, I don't think users really have too much sensitivity between paying 1/100th of a penny versus 2/100ths of a penny. One of the things I do think is interesting about Monad though, is that like those pop-ups where you're, you know, clicking through the gas stuff, it's my understanding that on average, a user will spend 8 seconds navigating through that pop-up. And that pop-up only happens after you've locked in the transactions call data and like the routes and stuff like that. And so I do wonder if there might be value in using one of these gasless systems, which actually, like, you know, candidly increases the actual cost of the gas.
Oh yeah.
Absolutely it does. But like the neat thing is that it's not just about, you know, making the transaction feel gasless. It's also about speed, right? It's about not having to have the user just like click, click. Oh, what does this mean? Am I not spending all my money? Click. And now 16 or 17 blocks have gone by and things have changed. So I think that like there could be some interesting room there for just like working around the, you know, user's proclivity for reading pop-ups. Does that resonate with y'all?
Yeah, that does make sense. And there is a couple of solutions that we can have toward that end. Number one, the next version of our router actually does support, even though our backend doesn't actually utilize it when it comes to constructing the transaction data, it actually does support Uniswap's permit too. So So there are things that we could do. You know, like for one, we do have like the try multiple routes thing, right? So that is something that we can definitely utilize as like a first step towards having those, what was it, like 8 seconds be as inconsequential when it came to user signings transactions. But since we are adding things like permit to support, or you can just give a bajillion allowance to our contract anyway, right? Then it does kind of allow us to if we do integrate it with our backend, that does allow us to kind of recalculate the route and have us sign and submit the transaction, right? So there are options that we could explore toward that end, some of which that we've already partially implemented.
That last one that you mentioned, I find very interesting. Would love to double click on that if it's not leaking too much of the trade secrets. In terms of,
I mean, we would just recalculate the route and submit the transaction. Like, I mean, it's not. I don't know if there's anything that revolutionary. Just approve us to spend all of your money, right?
Like, so in that case, the flow would be the user kind of like says like, well, so right now it's my understanding the user is signing over a, you know, set of multiple possible routes, and then
goes. Exactly.
And so in the model you're describing, it could just be that like the user says, all right, I am not going to see the routes, but I am signing over the minimum amount out that I'm requiring. And then they send it to you. And then you guys inject the routes. And then it goes
That's the beauty of permit too, right? They are pre-signing their their allowance in an off-chain manner that you know, they're allowing us to spend their funds, right? So, you know, they just, oh, I want to spend this much. And then, you know, instead of the route being calculated, the transactions bundle, it takes them 8 seconds or whatever to sign it, right? They just approve that we're allowed to spend, you know, that amount in an off-chain manner. And then, you know, we can get that, sign a transaction ourselves and actually execute what they've approved. That's the, you know, that's, I don't know how revolutionary that is, but if we were are willing to front the cost of gas, that seems like the simplest way we would achieve that end.
That makes sense to me. I think in the Ethereum world, people would refer to that as an intent. I would not. To me, that seems more like a limit order. But maybe a subcategory of intent. It's Ethereum people love this kind of thing.
I mean, I don't think it's a limit order. It's just like a market order, but you know,
with a floor though, right?
I mean, yeah.
It's like, yeah, but yeah, you're right, though. It's not a limit order either. A limit order is more of like a
I don't know. I was more so saying, like, from the perspective of you want the best route, like, as soon as possible to things executed. Like, okay, like, it's just like the Kraken experience where, you know, you don't have to sign when you hit the slider. You just, the transaction happens when you click send, right? Which,
yes,
I think is what, or rather, the trade happens when you click send, not I try to figure out how to get the trade before I hit send. And then there's latency involved.
That resonates with me. Yeah, I like the way you guys are thinking about it. It's like, you know, there's a lot of moving pieces, especially with like distributed systems, like layer one blockchains. And we haven't even mentioned like MEV and where MEV fits into this part. And so I like the way you guys are thinking about it. And I really look forward to seeing, you know, how this.
I mean,
you know,
we're still a little ways out from paying for the user's gas, but it is definitely something we're thinking about.
Yeah. So let me ask you this. Is there anything in particular that you guys are excited about with the future? Like any features that are coming on the pipeline or anything in particular that is alpha for the viewers?
Honestly, to be honest, one of the things I'm most excited about is that because of the way that we are deploying our infrastructure, we are actually planning to open source release some of our tooling that we use to deploy our stuff. I know that's not great for most users, but, and I'm happy to elaborate a little bit on that later on as well. But mostly it's just, the points program. I think that'll be fun. Basically trying to maximize engagement more. I absolutely hate the Windows something happened error screen. So one of the things that we are also improving on the back end is actually making more feedback as to why what you want isn't happening. As a side effect, the you don't have minimum balance error is actually a little malformatted right now. Because it actually says like blah 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 cannot execute contracts. So basically observability is on why thing went wrong is actually something that's important to me personally. Always look out for the swaps app improving in performance. I know again these going to the more unobservable backend changes that we've discussed, but there will come a time where things suddenly feel faster and you'll be like, huh, that's cool.
That makes sense to me. I think like, cause like a lot of that too kind of plugs into like, you know, the front end and how that all interacts with the backend and the validator and
just
the
general flow. We soft launched like a slight redesign of the app as well, which was cool. And things feel a lot cleaner now, which is great. I don't know, man. I'm just looking forward to how the entire project shapes and its offshoot stuff shapes over time.
Very, very cool. Anything that you'd like to leave us with as we close out the end of the podcast?
Oh damn, I'm bad at closers. Harmeet, you take over.
It was actually really great speaking with you, Alex. As always. I think we had a lot of great conversation. Beyond that, yeah, we appreciate you inviting us on, letting us talk a little bit about, you know, kind of how Mace works a little bit more under the hood, which we're always happy to talk about. So I think we went over, you know, some interesting design decisions that we're taking, how that's going to help us with scalability and the future for mainnet. Beyond that, yeah, you know, if anyone does have questions or they're interested, you can always, hit us up on Discord. The whole team's pretty active, so we're always happy to chat with you guys. And yeah, if you guys have feedback on the app or anything you'd like to see, please let us know about that as well. We're always open to suggestions and constantly, you know, implementing those over time. Obviously, we are a smaller team, so don't expect those changes to be implemented overnight. But we are obviously really happy that, you know, people are using the app and give us feedback, and, you know, we'll make it better over time. So yeah, appreciate everyone for using it, you know, engaging with our community, holding the NFT, everything else. You know, we're all taking notice, and, you know, hopefully delivering a better experience every day.
Oh, yeah, I genuinely can't wait till we have the Mesa beta pass access. That'll be fun as we start rolling out all the new features that we're cooking up.
Yeah, so that's some alpha for everyone listening to the podcast. So if you guys do want to try out the app early, probably rack up some points ahead of other people, yeah, get the NFT pass. That will be your ticket into early access.
That's awesome. I'm definitely going to be one of those people. I'm very impressed with what you guys are building. I think that so often with aggregators in particular on blockchains, we just see, you know, more of the same. But y'all's approach is, to me, just very innovative. It's doing a lot of things that other teams have never even considered doing before in a way that I think is going to just deliver a lot of value that other teams just don't and can't.
My light bulb moment, and the, you know, going back to my personal journey here, how do I make something in a way that requires me to do less work in the future?
Yeah. It's a good design. It's a good design principle. I love it. I'm super bullish on what you guys are doing. I think that in particular on Monad, there are a lot of teams that are just copying and pasting stuff from other like blockchains, or just like, you know, trying to be like, you know, the Uniswap of Monad, or just like that kind of stuff. I am a big fan of teams that are innovating and pushing the design space and building stuff that is new. And what you guys are doing is not something I've ever seen on any other blockchain, and it works. It's technically, you know, very GigaBrain to be sure, but it is something that I just am very impressed with. And I am, you know, super excited to use it, super excited to you know, see how your team evolves, and super excited to see you guys just contribute so much to the Monad ecosystem.
I appreciate that.
Thank you. I appreciate it.
Cool. Well, guys, thank you so much for joining us. Thank you so much for, you know, sharing all this information and for indulging me as we go through your tech stack. Would love to keep the conversation going. Would love to have you guys back on again.
You as well. Appreciate being here.
Thanks, guys.